Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about a recent report that looks at the state of emergency medical care in the United States. First time ever there has been an attempt to look state by state to quantify along a number of dimensions, the emergency medical care that's available, and try to come up with, in a sense, a national kind of report card. And the results are not very good. In fact, the overall national grade for the United States for emergency care is a C-. And there are some states that for their overall grades even do less well than that. One, for example, is our neighboring state of Indiana that gets an overall grade of D+. We'll be talking this morning about this study and about what we know about emergency medicine across the country with Dr. Frederick Blum. He is the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He is also an associate professor of emergency medicine, pediatrics, and internal medicine at West Virginia University School of Medicine. That's in Morgantown, West Virginia. And he's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk, as always, questions are welcome. We only ask people to just try and be brief so we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving along. But anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Dr. Blum, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm very good.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. This report, the one that we're talking about, the National Report Card on the State of Emergency Medicine, was released formally, I believe, around the middle of January. So it's been out a couple of months now. And as I understand it, no one had ever done this before. No one had sat down and tried to do, in some way, to quantify the quality of care, look at care available in every state, put that all together and do state-by-state rating, and also do something of a national kind of picture to talk about how we're doing as a country. I'm just curious, why it is that apparently before nobody had tried to do this?
Well, the first of all, it's very difficult to do, to try to quantify something that's as complex as the delivery of emergency care is actually quite a daunting task. So that's one of the issues. The other is I think we just hadn't thought about doing it in this way. We've obviously our organization is involved in advocacy in a number of ways in and around the subject of emergency medicine, but we had not thought about doing it in this way. So this idea came to us when we got a new executive director here in the last couple of years who had. Dean Wilkerson, who is our executive director now, had previously been the director of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and they had used this technique to great effect with that organization. And so he brought this idea to us, and we thought it was a good idea, and so we gave it a shot and tried to come up with a report that could help us evaluate the nation's emergency care system and hopefully make some changes to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could talk specifically about a little bit about how it is you did this and how Illinois and Indiana, for example, stack up. And
then
some sort of overall picture, just to give people an idea of how Illinois ranks and with some of our surrounding states here. For the overall grade, state of Missouri gets a C+. Iowa gets a C+. Illinois gets a C. Wisconsin gets a C-, and Indiana gets a D+. So Indiana was, in fact, one of the lowest overall, lowest rated states. And as I mentioned, the overall, if you take all these overall grades for the entire country and average them out, you get a C-. Was this, did you anticipate that it might be as bad as that going into this?
Frankly, we did, because those of us that that practice emergency medicine know that the situation has deteriorated in the last 10 to 15 years. And so it really, I have to be honest and say that it really didn't come as a surprise to us that the scores were not very good.
Mm-hmm. Nobody, no state overall either got an A or an F. Apparently, the states that rated most highly were California, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and District of Columbia. And then on the other end, those states that got overall grades of D plus or D were Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Indiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, Virginia, Washington, and Wyoming. So most of the states were somewhere in C plus to D. So apparently there were very few that were at the top of the list, and most did not score well, and even less well than that. So really down near the bottom.
Yes, that's correct. It is like I said, not surprising, but it's a bit discouraging. You know, that we have this this situation that exists in the country right now.
Yeah. One of the things that the report points out that I think is worth noting is that over time, the demand for emergency medical care has gone up significantly. The most recent numbers you have are from 2003, and it was as high as it ever been. And at the same time, the availability of emergency care has been going down. Apparently, a number of emergency departments have actually closed in the past, say, 10 years.
That's correct. We have seen over the last 10 years or so the number of emergency departments decline by as much as 500 total emergency departments in the country during that time. At the same time, emergency department volume continues to go up and up and up. The most recent figures we have are 114 million visits a year. We think that's probably closer to 118 million this year, although those numbers won't be out for a while. But the demand for services continue to go up, while the number of emergency departments certainly has not matched that. And so the volume in any given emergency department has gone up, which has created a huge capacity problem for us. We simply are overcrowded in many of our emergency departments in the country right now.
And something else I suppose it's also worth mentioning is that emergency departments cannot turn people away. If someone comes to you and they're seriously in need of medical attention, you can't say, well, we're sorry. You'll have to go get help someplace else.
That's correct. Actually, there's a law in this country that we refer to as the Umtala Law that actually puts that into law, but emergency physicians always have adopted that long before the law existed. We have adopted the policy of seeing everybody who seeks our care to the best of our ability. This law simply put that into the nation's law, made it a law, but it was pretty much our practice, since the inception of emergency medicine.
Mm-hmm. And there's a connection between that, or perhaps between the problem of overburdened emergency rooms and for many people, the lack of access to care in the United States. There are people that if they perhaps had other avenues, they would use them. But if you don't have them, then your last resort, or maybe your only resort, is to go to the emergency room. And not all of those cases are emergencies.
That's correct, although it's a misconception to believe that the nation's the crowding in the nation's emergency departments are due to people who don't belong to be there, don't deserve to be there or shouldn't be there because they have minor illness. That's actually a bit of a misconception. It is true, however, that when patients cannot get care in other parts of the system, primary care, especially when they have chronic illness, that illness gets worse to the point where they have to seek care in the emergency department, and that drives up the number of emergency department visits. So we look at the emergency department as a kind of a barometer of the nation's healthcare system. when the nation's healthcare system is not performing at its best, the volume in the emergency department goes up. And we're in the middle of that right now, unfortunately.
We have a caller. We will get right to. Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Frederick Blum. He's the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and he is also an associate professor of emergency medicine, pediatrics, and internal medicine at West Virginia University School of Medicine in Morgantown, West Virginia. We're talking about a report that was made public in January, taking a look at the health of emergency medical care in the United States, looking at it on a state-by-state basis, coming up with an overall grade for each state and then an overall grade for the United States. And the finding of the report was that overall, the emergency medicine system here in the United States has earned overall a grade of C-, the report says, barely above a D. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to start us off, Champagne. Line one. Hello.
Hi. My name is Grant Antfine. I'm a board member with the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers mm-hmm. in Champaign County here. I just wanted to ask Dr. Blum what he perceives to be the solution to this low-grade issue. Is it higher Medicaid, higher reimbursements? Is it just revamping our policies dealing with uninsured for primary care, or is it going so far as a national single-payer program?
Well, like any large complex system that is the nation's healthcare system, when you look at healthcare in this country, it's I believe a $1.4 trillion enterprise. And when you look at any kind of system that's that large, there's not an easy answer to your question. Reimbursement is certainly a big part of the problem. About 50% of emergency care is completely unreimbursed. And so for many hospitals, they make the business decision that they simply can't afford to keep their emergency department open. We've also seen a trend in this country of for reimbursement issues and also because of professional liability issues of the development of specialty hospitals where doctors of a single or related specialty will band together and open a specialty hospital. Many of these do not even have emergency departments, so that reduces the availability of the service. The professional liability crisis in medicine is a big part of it. In my state, in West Virginia, we were recently fortunate enough to pass some tort reform laws, but prior to that time, we had lost many of our specialists in the state, many of our surgical specialists like neurosurgeons and hand surgeons and others. And so there simply was not those doctors available to be on call to the emergency department to care for people. It became a real struggle for us to find care for those specific kinds of problems in our emergency departments in our state, which led to which added to the problem of crowding. There's also 47 million uninsured in this country. Those folks require care and in large numbers, they get that care in the emergency department. So all of those things are important parts of the equation. We've had reduced Medicaid reimbursement in recent years, but the care doesn't go away. It's just the reimbursement goes down, but the care remains the same. So hospitals are put in an increasing bind to be able to care for folks and. Those are all parts of the problem. I'm sorry. It's kind of a long-winded answer, but it's a complex problem.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Chicago. This is another caller, line four. Hello.
Hello. I have a specific question and a broad question. My specific question is, shouldn't the condition of the U.S.'s emergency departments be an issue for homeland security? And perhaps that's one way the government can enter and help. The broad question is that isn't this really just the crisis of hospitals in period? I mean, Vanderbilt in Tennessee, their burn unit seems to be in danger of closing because they're overwhelmed by the methamphetamine victims that they have and the lack of reimbursement. There's also just the horrific problem of sanitation in the hospitals across the nation to the point where, a staph infection is almost guaranteed, and hospitals are becoming very dangerous for people in their 80s because of that. So is this crisis in for emergency departments just a general crisis of our hospital system at the time?
Well, I'll start with the second part of your question. You're absolutely right. This really is simply a symptom of the overall problems facing hospitals in this country. When the ICUs are full, an ICU patient that comes into the emergency department often has to stay there and receive care for hours, sometimes days. That creates a backlog, and that room is occupied, that nurse is occupied. And so new people coming into the emergency department, are going to have a harder time getting seen and cared for. And the whole system kind of backlogs. It becomes we refer to it as gridlock in the specialty. But the whole system backs up. So you're exactly right. It's a symptom of the overall problems with hospitals and, all the problems they're facing. But the first part of your question is actually very astute, and actually we have made that case in a national arena. This is critical to homeland security. We've seen that with natural disasters such as Katrina. We've seen it with some other things that have occurred around the country. We know, for instance, that 80% of people from a flu epidemic or from a terrorist attack or from a hurricane will bypass the EMS system and go directly to the emergency department. So it makes the emergency department part of the first response for the country. If our emergency departments are already at or over capacity, that response is going to be limited. And we've made that case as recently as this month with the Committee on Homeland Security who are talking about the response to an avian flu epidemic, for instance. So you're exactly right. If we truly want to be prepared as a country, we need to create capacity, what we call surge capacity, in our nation's emergency departments, because I can tell you that capacity currently is not there. That's a great question.
I had a second question, third question, if you don't mind. You gave the grade by state. Did you look within the state by counties?
No, we didn't break it down that far. And I know in states like Illinois, for instance, there is a huge difference between the urban areas of the state and the rural areas of the state. But unfortunately, we didn't have the ability to break it down into smaller units such as that.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. It's very, the number that you gave just a moment ago in response to the caller's question is really striking, that 80% of the people who would be hurt, say, in a natural disaster or in a terrorist attack, you expect would bypass completely the EMS system and they would go directly to the emergency room, making it important for preparedness for those kind of events to be able to absorb that number of people. I mean, given that, and given the fact that you said you actually made the pitch to the federal government on that issue, is anybody on the federal level talking about putting federal resources into building up the system?
Well, not so far. That we certainly would like to see that occur. We've made some moves in that direction. The college, for instance, just received a grant from the Homeland Security Department to work on some of these issues. We continue to work on some of the issues with preparedness that are kind of related to this issue, such as the issue of syndromic surveillance, the computer system, linking the computer systems of emergency departments in a way that enables us to be able to identify early on an epidemic or a terrorist, a bioterrorist attack, for instance, is important to Homeland Security, and so we continue to work on that issue. But this is really an infrastructure issue. It's not really something that you can fix by saying we're gonna designate this amount of money to create, quote, preparedness. I mean, if those emergency departments don't exist, if they've gone out of business, then they've gone out of business. When a trauma center closes, it closes for everybody. So this is really an infrastructure problem, and the problem has to be addressed at the basic infrastructure level of the nation's healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about something else that you try to get at, and I guess my understanding is that though this is information that's that is not kept completely or incompletely addressed, and that is ambulance diversion. And I guess I understand that that means that what happens essentially if a particular institution, a particular healthcare institution, a hospital, if their emergency room is full and if they're stacking people up and they simply have no place to put them, then an ambulance that might be looking for a place to bring someone who was injured and called in to that hospital, that emergency room, they'd say, look, we're sorry, but there's no room. We can't, you know, we talked about earlier, they can't turn people away. Well, if they're full to capacity, if they don't have any place to put someone, they can indeed say, we're sorry, but we can't take this person. And so then that means that person will have to go someplace else. And I'm assuming that also means that what they'll try to do is find the closest place they can take someone. And if then that place is full, then they might have to take additional time. It might mean additional distance getting someone someplace where they can have care. This is apparently something that most states don't keep track of, and you would like to actually know more about.
Yeah, absolutely true. Are you still there?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I had a click on my line. That's very true. There's not good data on that around the country. It's largely an urban issue in areas that have multiple hospitals. In rural parts of the country like mine, the diversion isn't as big of a problem, even though capacity is still a problem. Because there's simply, you know, in Morgantown, West Virginia, there's not a lot of options to divert to. So when my hospital's full, we do the best we can, taking additional patients sometimes, and sometimes they do get stacked up. And actually, in many systems around the country, practice of diversion has been discouraged or legislated out of business. And so the problem now is actually one of offloading of patients. Ambulances now tell us that they can go to the emergency department, but it's very often they have to wait extended periods of time to move their patient from the ambulance gurney to a hospital bed because simply there isn't any hospital beds, you know, to move the patient to. So it's more of a turnaround problem right now, but it's simply a reflection of the capacity problems. If we had the capacity in our emergency departments, diversion would go away as an issue.
All right, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I just tuned in recently, so I may have missed this, but several years ago my daughter had a appendicitis.
Uh-huh.
She called in great pain and about 9 in the morning, and we went over and got her and took her to the emergency room, but they didn't see her until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it almost ruptured by the time they had gotten her to surgery. I heard later that had we called a 911 ambulance, she would have been seen earlier because of the triage system. Is that correct?
Well, there certainly is a tendency to, triage nurses and doctors are human, and they tend to sometimes pay more attention to someone that arrives on a gurney as opposed to, you know, arriving walking in the front door because the assumption is, you know, the person that arrives by ambulance is inherently more ill. So there is that.
That doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
It doesn't make much sense, but that's often how things are interpreted.
I mean, we would have called 911.
I can tell you that we try not to fall into that trap of making that assumption. But by the same token, what your experience was reflects what we've been talking about, which is that quite often people have to wait an extended period of time to be seen simply because there are not beds to put them in to begin the evaluation.
Right.
That's a big part of the problem. We certainly believe that care would be better if we had the capacity, to see everybody in a timely fashion. Believe me, emergency physicians are very tuned in to seeing people in as timely fashion as possible. That's what we do. But we need to have the resources to do that. If you don't have enough beds, if you don't have enough nurses, you have to simply try to do the best you can with what you have.
Yeah. I experienced that in the emergency room with another patient just recently here in town where, the hospital beds upstairs were full, so people were still in the emergency room, which meant that no one else could be brought in from the waiting room to be seen.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I've had the situation in my own emergency department where 18 of my 22 beds were occupied by patients who had already had admission papers turned in, but there were simply no beds for them to go to.
So there were people still waiting in ambulances to get in.
Absolutely true. And that's a situation that is duplicated all around the country, and it's certainly not the situation that we'd like. But this simply reflects what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'm interested in hearing more about your study.
Thank you for the call. Other people who are listening are also welcome to call if you have questions. We're just a little bit past the midpoint here, so I should introduce again the guest. We're talking with Dr. Frederick Blum. He is the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He is also associate professor of emergency medicine, pediatrics, and internal medicine at West Virginia University School of Medicine in Morgantown, West Virginia. And he is talking with us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Just to again, mention that this report here, came out in January, looks at every state by state, gives an overall grade for the country, that's the C-, gives an overall grade for the states, and here, just for people who are listening where we are, Illinois gets an overall grade of C, Indiana gets an overall grade of D+. It was one of the lowest rated states. And I want to talk a little bit about the various categories here, and maybe you can talk just in a little bit more detail about what, within these four categories, that's access to care, quality and patient safety, public health and injury prevention, the medical liability environment, just what goes into them. But I tell you what, I have a caller, and they're in Indiana, so rather than make them wait, I want to go ahead and bring them into the conversation. This would be line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, yeah. I remember reading the evaluation when it came out first in our newspaper here. I've been in the ER, in fact, the last 2 weeks, 2 times, and recently they just revamped it. You now have individual rooms to be seen, and I've been quite happy with it. Just 2 nights ago I was there and got seen very quickly and things like that, and so it must be that there's extremely long ranges between one emergency room and another within my state here in Indiana. I'm going to put a positive spin on it. I've never had any problems, which makes me think what other people have been saying is that there's some subtleties I might be missing, but it looks like you're going into that part of the categories right now, so I'll just hop off and listen to you. But I'm one person that's been completely satisfied, and I have a chronic disease, so I think where I am, at least, things are going pretty well. On the gross side, if you can't get in, that would be bad. You know, there's no beds and things like that. I've never experienced that, so I thought there might be more subtle things the way you analyze this that you might bring up in your discussion that follows. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Certainly, emergency physicians around the country would all like to duplicate your experience. We're like anybody else. We want to provide the best possible service we can as quickly as we can, and we would all like to duplicate that. I can tell you there is a lot of emergency department to emergency department variability, but there's also a lot of variability over time within the same emergency department. I can tell you my emergency department is crowded much of the time these days, but still has periods where it's gets quiet and the number of beds is not an issue. It's possible that you've been there during those times. It's also possible that the emergency department that you use doesn't really see or feel some of these problems, and there's a lot of variation from community to community on this. I just would say, that's certainly the situation that we want to duplicate, but unfortunately, in many emergency departments, it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah, well, I think that does indeed get at the point, as you say, and as the caller says, that it may well depend on where you're living, not just from one state to another, but from one part of the state to another. I know that, for example, here in Champaign-Urbana, it's the home of the University of Illinois, we have several large clinics and hospitals, and that the reaction of local people who in healthcare here is that they thought that at least this area, Champaign-Urbana, was doing pretty well. And I imagine that because of the presence of the University of Illinois and the fact that we have now these clinics, some of them are associated with the med school that we have here, that we might be better set up than some other of the more rural counties here in downstate Illinois when you get outside of Cook County and the Collar County, so that we might be a little bit of an exception. So if you're in Champaign-Urbana, maybe the situation is better than if you were in, again, one of those counties. And there are a number of counties in downstate Illinois where the population is really pretty small. And their access is going to be limited. Depending where you are, you might be some distance from the nearest emergency room. So that kind of thing is going to make a lot of difference, just simply where you live.
Absolutely true. The you know, if you look at the numbers that make up the category of access to emergency care for Illinois, they actually did pretty well in that category. B+, which is one of the better grades in the country in access, the number of emergency departments per million people, the number of the number of doctors available to treat those patients. So actually, that subcategory in Illinois was its best grade. So access does not seem to be as big an issue for Illinois as it is for some parts of the country. Indiana actually had a C in that category, so it fared much worse in some other categories within our report. So it, even within a state with a low grade, there's a range of what goes into that grade, the various subgrades, as it were.
Right. Well, maybe we should talk. I mentioned we would talk just a little bit about what goes into these four broad categories that you look at. And now you've just mentioned that first one, access to care, and the fact that we Illinois gets B+ here, or at least on the thing that I'm looking at, it says Indiana got C-. Now, maybe that's not...
Oh, I'm sorry. I misread it. You're right. It's C-.
So, and there, Iowa gets B-, Missouri gets B+, Wisconsin gets B-, and that... When we're talking about access to care, that, as you said, it sounds as if basically that just is sort of a measure of how many people you have in the state, how many emergency rooms you have, how many doctors there are available to staff them. That sounds like it's pretty fairly straightforward.
Yeah, it's also how many nurses. It's also number of hospital staffed beds, which goes into the overall thing. It's per capita spending on health care. It's Medicaid reimbursement, Medicare reimbursement. All of those things go into that access part of the equation.
The next category, quality and patient safety. Here, there's a huge spread between the states, Illinois and states surrounding. Just to mention, we got Iowa gets an A-. The state of Illinois gets a C. State of Indiana gets a D, Missouri gets a C+, and Wisconsin gets a D+. What goes into quality and patient safety?
Well, this is perhaps the most misunderstood part of this grade, and this is actually what has gotten us probably the most feedback from various folks. The one thing I want to point out about this grade is not meant to reflect any individual hospital or physician or groups of physicians. It's simply meant to reflect the state's support for the issues of quality and patient safety. And so the things that go into that include things like, is the state committed to training more emergency physicians through residency programs in emergency medicine? What percent of the population has access to advanced life support ambulances? What percent of the population has access to online, does that EMS system have access to online medical direction? Does the population have access to enhanced 911, which we think improves care? What are the public health, plans that are in place to help prevent, you know, injury and disease in those states? So, but this area particularly was one where we think that a lot needs to be done to develop data points to measure quality. One of the things we found with this report was it's very difficult to measure quality in emergency medicine because it's such a complex enterprise. So one of the things we'll be working on before we do our next report card is to try to develop better data to reflect this.
Is there a big spread across the country in terms of access to or availability of 911 services?
Surprisingly, we found there was. Actually, that was an area of the report that took me personally a little bit by surprise. It is very variable around the country. And it's also very variable within the state. I mean, we saw huge ranges of difference even within an individual state. And so it makes coming up with the state grade somewhat difficult, actually.
Let's talk with someone else. We have someone calling from around Leroy on a cell phone here, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah. Hi. Very interesting program. Had just a couple of quick comments, a couple of questions that I'll ring off since I'm on the cell. My family and I actually moved to a small rural community out of Chicago about 10 years ago. And we enjoyed quite a bit. We have a small 23-bed hospital, which the community is, fighting to keep open, obviously. And I believe a lot of the emergency room doctors over the weekend actually come from Chicago, kind of a doc-for-hire type of situation, if you will. And really, any sort of an emergency, the hospital is almost like a triage center where they're stabilized and, I believe, taken to Champaign or wherever. My comment was there's kind of an 800-pound elephant in the room with a crisis just beneath the surface in rural hospitals. I understand that the aging of the population for the nurses is quite a situation. And just to make it personal, I had a couple of nieces that grew up in the area, became nurses, and really for the opportunity and whatever, moved up to Chicago and are nurses up in a hospital in Chicago. And so this, in a few years, this, I think, is going to be quite a situation, quite a critical situation. And the other instance, I have a friend who is a fireman in Danville, which is a little bit bigger community just by us here. And when they go out to the projects, housing projects, for some sort of a crisis, because of the neighborhood, whatever, they have a full entourage of police officers with flap jackets and, whatever for protection. And usually they go to rescue somebody who's unfortunately fallen off the, bathroom toilet. And, you have all these personnel and all these costs. And I don't know how we can address that or if we could even put that genie back in a bottle. But I thought perhaps it was two areas that your guests might want to comment on. And I'll go ahead and ring off.
Thanks. Okay.
He's absolutely right. In many parts of the country, it often is quite labor intensive to get to and care for an ambulance patient. That's true in urban areas as he described, and it's also true in rural areas sometimes because of location and terrain. There are parts of the county that I work in that are an hour ambulance ride away from the hospital. This is a big problem in many parts of the country. The problem in rural hospitals is especially acute, and you could understand that I would be kind of tuned into that, being from a state like West Virginia, which has many one-hospital towns. Not only does it have many one-hospital towns, it has many small hospital within that system, and those hospitals are critical to that community because in certain kinds of emergencies, there's just no substitute for being close by. Even with the advent of air transport and paramedic training that enables them to do long transports, in some cases, you know, providing an airway for someone or you know, giving a life-saving medication simply is a function of being close. And so closing a 23-bed hospital, if it's the only health care available for a small rural county, is a bad idea. Yet those are the hospitals that are particularly put at risk by poor reimbursement. Those are the hospitals that are particularly put at risk by the professional liability crisis, because it's hard for them to get doctors to take call to the emergency department, for instance, because of the higher risk of caring for people in the emergency department from a medical legal standpoint. I know that was the big problem with our crisis in West Virginia. So the caller points out some really important parts of the equation here, which is, you know, we have to preserve the network. Again, it gets back to infrastructure. The basic healthcare infrastructure of the country is threatened, and we have to figure out how to fix it. Because the other thing he mentioned was the nursing shortage, which is probably the single biggest limitation to access that we have within the system, both in the emergency department and in the ICUs and in the hospitals. Frankly, many times we have beds, but we don't have any nurses to staff those beds. And it's a huge demographic time bomb, because the baby boomers right now are pretty healthy. But in another 10 years, the baby boom generation is going to be pretty sick. And right now, most of the nurses in this country are baby boomers themselves, and they're going to be looking to retire. So, huge problem.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Frederick Blum. He's president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He is also associate professor of emergency medicine, pediatrics, and internal medicine at West Virginia University School of Medicine in Morgantown, West Virginia. And we're talking about a study that came out in January, around the middle of January, looking at the state of medical care, emergency medical care in the United States, looking at state by state, coming up with an overall grade for each state and an overall grade for the country. And as I have here mentioned a couple of times, the overall grade that the country gets is C-. And there are some states that overall are more poorly rated than that, one of them being our neighboring state of Indiana that gets an overall grade of D+. It was one of the lowest rated. And questions here are welcome. We'll continue to take them as long as we have time. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll talk next with someone in Oakwood. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have another suggestion based on my personal experience. I think there's very poor communication between the 911 people, the ambulance, the person who is calling the 911, and the hospital, that whole system. It seems to me there's a lot of time and information, time wasted and information that is not received by the medical people from the person who's calling 911, that could be of great importance, because it isn't until the ambulance actually showed up at my house that they began to gather any medical information about what was going on. My husband was a very large man, and they were unable to get the gurney upstairs, so they had to call a second ambulance to help get him down, and should have been something that they knew before they even arrived. So it occurred to me later that it would be helpful if there was some kind of a screening tool that 911 people used when they received a call to check out where is the person, what kind of medicines does he take, what is the problem, where is he located, are we going to have any trouble getting at him? Things like that, that would have saved time.
The problem you describe is a very important one, and I can tell you around the country there's a great deal of variability as to how that problem is being addressed. One of the things we've tried to do around the country is develop information systems that help identify people with chronic illness and create a kind of database on the kind of things you're talking about, so that when a call comes to 911 about a patient with a chronic illness, you know, the operator can pull up a screen that says, you know, this is the person, this is the medicines they're on, these are the problems that they have, this might be a problem as far as accessing the patient in his or her home. We are continuing to work at that, but quite frankly, it's still work in process. The problem that the caller points out is a very real one. And again, there's a great deal of variation there. In my hospital, for instance, the ambulance information comes directly into my emergency department, so I get a little bit better information than some hospitals do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd sure like to see something. It seems to me like such an obvious thing that could be fixed.
Well, it would seem that way, but the problems to try to fix it are actually huge. It may not seem like they should be, but there are actually huge problems. There are issues of confidentiality, who has access to that information, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it actually is a very complex problem.
All right, thank you. Let's start with someone in Crystal Lake in line number two. Hello. The call there, line two. Okay, well, otherwise, we certainly welcome other questions. We probably have time maybe for one, at least in a couple of minutes that we have left. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Let me just give you an opportunity to talk real quick about one of the other categories here in which states are rated, where it seems that none of the states here, the Illinois or the surrounding states, did particularly well, and that is public health and injury prevention. Illinois gets D+. Indiana, Iowa gets C's, Missouri gets D+, Wisconsin gets D+. That's not terribly good. What goes into that category?
Well, the kind of things that go into that category are things like automobile safety laws, you know, seatbelt laws, alcohol-related crashes and alcohol laws, helmet use for motorcycles, substance abuse and availability of treatment programs for substance abuse, immunization rates. Injury prevention programs. Is there a fall prevention program or a child safety seat program in those areas and that sort of thing. So these are all kind of public health injury prevention areas. Quite frankly, the low grades there are a function oftentimes of the laws. For instance, I noticed Illinois doesn't have a helmet law for motorcycle safety, obviously a big area of contention in many states. I know in my state of West Virginia, we do have a helmet law, but we fight that fight virtually every legislative session. We know that helmets save lives and reduce injury, yet it's an issue of personal choice and personal freedom for many people, and so the fight goes on to try to get those laws enacted. But that's what goes into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been very much here, I believe, in the state of Illinois. There are people who think that would be a good thing, but the prevailing view seems to be that that's too much intrusion of government into people's individual lives, and so it's never gone in the Illinois legislature.
Unfortunately, there are individual rights, and then there's societal, concerns. The cost to society of caring for a head-injured motorcycle crash victim is huge and is in the category of multiple millions of dollars cost to society. And so, I don't have the answers to these questions. Obviously, I'm biased in favor of helmet laws because of what I do. But when does the interest of society outweigh the interest of the individual with regard to laws like that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what each state has to kind of struggle with.
We will try to get at least one more caller. Next in line is Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I graduated, I taught in West Virginia University in Marshall in the mid-70s. We had an outreach program. Did you mention about the southern part of the state? I always thought that was really an area that, in terms of in West Virginia, how the coverage was there.
Well, probably similar to the rural parts of the state in Illinois, the more rural parts of our state, actually there aren't a lot of urban parts to West Virginia. It tends to be mostly urban, mostly rural.
Rural, yeah.
But there are parts of our state, especially in southern West Virginia, because of terrain and other issues that are really pretty remote. And that's really the issue I was talking about earlier, where a small hospital of 20 beds may be critical to that little community just because of how isolated they are. you know, from care that may be, you know, an hour or 2 hours away by reasonable transport. So, you know, trying to figure out how to support the system in those parts of the country is very difficult.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We'll go to Chicago, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. This was told to me by the son of a cousin of mine about 30 years ago. He went to med school in Belgium. He couldn't get into an American med school because he had goofed around the first 2.5 years in undergraduate school and finally decided he wanted to go to med school. And so he went through med school in Belgium, did his internship up in Canada at the university in Montreal, the med school attached there. But because of the law not recognizing foreign med schools or internships, he had to do another year's internship in the United States, which he did in Westchester County in New York. And this was told to me as he was opening up an office in Long Island as an OBGYN, doing that sort of practice. And he told me the emergency situation, emergency room situations in the United States, as he experienced it and saw it, was miserable. Frequently, the hospitals were not staffed by, the emergency rooms were not staffed by experienced doctors. They relied on interns, and as opposed to Canada and Europe having experienced doctors on hand all the time.
We're real short on time here. I got to see if I can get a comment from our guest, Dr. Blum. I guess that maybe the way to bring it up to where we are is to ask the question, do you think that other countries do better?
Well, I'm biased, obviously. Emergency medicine is largely an American construct. Emergency medicine, as we know it, doesn't exist in many parts of the world, including in many parts of Europe. They have a different system, which would take too long to describe right now. So what the caller describes was actually true of American emergency medicine in the 70s. Our specialty is only about 35 to 40 years old from its initial inception, and we still are a very young specialty that's still developing. We're in the early stages of our development even today, but it's changed dramatically from the 70s until now.
We start
to training.
We're going to have to stop there. We're at the end of the time. Dr. Blum, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Our guest is Dr. Frederick Blum. He is president of the American College of Emergency Physicians.